The following is an excerpt from the Science Podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Finally today, David Grimm, online news editor of Science, is here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site. First up, David, we have kind of a hot topic these days, whole genome sequencing.
Right. But Sarah, this isn't sequencing of adults or even children. This is sequencing of the unborn. Now, anybody who has been pregnant or knows somebody who has knows that we can already get some DNA information from fetuses. Doctors can do amniocentesis or something called villus sampling, which is basically just taking a snippet of placental tissue. But as you can imagine, both of these are pretty invasive. They involve getting a needle or a tube into the womb or the placenta, and this can actually cause miscarriages. So it's not ideal. But a lot of parents obviously want to know if their child has major genetic defects before bringing that child to term. So the question is there a better way of doing it that's not as invasive? And that's what this study is all about.
Yeah, I really like their method of taking advantage of the fact that DNA of the fetus escapes into the mom's bloodstream.
Actually, researchers have known since 1997 that there's actually a lot of free-floating DNA in the mom that is not hers but actually comes from the fetus. And in 2010, researchers showed there's actually enough of this fetal DNA swimming around that it should be possible, theoretically, to reconstruct all or almost all of the fetus's genome from this DNA. And in this new study, researchers actually have done just that. One of the hurdles has been that it's really actually hard to distinguish fetal DNA from the mother's DNA, because obviously the fetuses are sharing half of their DNA with the mom. So how do you distinguish one from the other? The idea is that if they're using statistical analysis, you should be able to tell there should be more of certain genetic variants present in the mom if both she has it and the fetus has it. And that's one way to sort of separate out the fetus's DNA from the mother's DNA. Also, they can actually take saliva samples from the dad to help sort of sort out what DNA is coming from the father and what is coming from the mother and what's coming from the fetus. So putting all this together, the researchers found that they could reconstruct a baby's genome with about 98% accuracy.
Which sounds great, but...
Which sounds great. It actually is really great. I mean, it's definitely much better than anybody could do before. There are a few drawbacks. If what are called new mutations form, these are new mutations that would form either after the sperm fuse with the egg or even in the sperm and the egg themselves. So it's mutations that would be present in the baby that might not actually be present in the parents. This new analysis actually missed a lot of them, actually created a lot of false positives as well, which is bad because you don't want to be thinking that your baby's going to have a disease that it actually doesn't.
So is this something that people can seek out today? Is it something they can get at a clinic?
With current technology, the researchers say it costs them about $50,000 per child to do this study. So this isn't the kind of thing that would be within most people's financial reach. But as with all genetic advances, the technology has a way of catching up with our finances pretty rapidly. Researchers are quickly closing in on the $1,000 genome, this ability to sort of sequence our entire genome for $1,000. So that suggests that probably within a few years, this technology actually may be both better than it is right now, but also a lot more financially viable.
Well, next up, we have a story that something I've never thought of before. What do mosquitoes do in the rain? How do they handle these missiles from the sky?
Right. Sarah, sometimes science answers questions that we haven't even asked. I certainly wasn't asking why raindrops don't swat down mosquitoes. But as you implied, scientists have actually figured out why this happens. And the reason it's such a mystery is because a raindrop falling on a mosquito is actually a pretty major collision. Raindrops weigh about 50 times as much as a mosquito weighs. That'd be like one of us being hit by a bus.
Wow.
And yet mosquitoes fly around in the rain all the time. And as far as we know, not a lot of them are getting killed by raindrops. So what's happening here? And actually, to figure it out, the researchers created a sort of a game of insect pinball. They got a bunch of mosquitoes into what they call a flight arena, which is basically a 20 centimeter high acrylic cage covered with a mesh top. And they basically shot jets of water at the mosquitoes to sort of replicate a raindrop hitting them from a very high altitude. And they filmed all this with a high-speed video camera. And what they found is, first of all, most of the mosquitoes, in fact, all the mosquitoes, were able to recover from the impacts of the drops without crashing to the bottom of the cage. The drops weren't killing the insects. They weren't even driving them into the ground.
And the insects weren't evading them.
A lot of times what was happening is that the drops weren't hitting the insects head on. They were just doing glancing blows to the wings or the legs, and the insects were able to pretty quickly recover. But even when the insects got a direct hit, they still recovered after falling no more than about 20 body lengths. So they fell a little bit, but then they were able to basically fly away, no harm, no foul.
Yeah, there's some great video of this on the site.
Right, there's some great video on the site.
And they just drop out of the screen after the drop hits them. So how are the mosquitoes able to deal with this?
They have a hard exoskeleton, which is almost like a coat of armor that they wear. That protects them a little bit. But researchers say the main protection is actually that the drops actually aren't hitting the mosquitoes with as much force as we think they are. They did a few more experiments, and they found that the water drops only slowed by about 2 to 17% when they hit the mosquito, which means that the drops are still retaining a lot of their energy. They're pretty much falling at the same rate they were before. If they were losing a lot of energy, they'd be transferring it to the insect as crushing force, which would really hurt or even kill the insect. But the fact that the drops keep on pretty much going at the same speed and are not really getting deformed after hitting the insect indicates that the insects really aren't absorbing a lot of force when they're getting hit by these drops. So in some ways, it's really not like us being hit by a bus, more like us sort of being tapped by a bus, and therefore the insects are able to fly away and bite us another day.
Okay. Our last story is on black holes roaming the universe.
Well, Sarah, we know there's black holes out there. We know there's very big black holes out there. But most of the black holes we know about are located in the center of a galaxy, which means that they're probably doing a lot of maybe not so pleasant stuff at the center of the galaxy, but they're sort of constrained in the center of the galaxy. But astronomers have wondered for a while if it's possible for one of these black holes to escape from its galaxy and start sort of free-floating through the universe, which is a bit of a scary concept. And it's got some new evidence in its favor thanks to this new study.
And so what were astronomers able to detect that made them think that this was going on?
They saw these two mysterious bright spots in a galaxy called CID 42. These galaxies never have very interesting names. 4 billion light years from Earth. And they trained the Hubble Space Telescope on these spots. And they found out that they belong to two very compact light sources. One seemed to be at the galaxy center, and the other one was a little offset from the center. They did a little bit more observation, and they discovered that the one that was offset from the center seemed to be emitting X-rays. And that's a very good sign that it is indeed a black hole. When black holes munch away at gas that's surrounding them, they emit X-rays. So they said, you know, it looks like this dot, which looks like a black hole, is not in its galaxy center, which means it looks like it somehow escaped from its galaxy or is in the process of escaping from the center of its galaxy.
These are two supermassive black holes. How do they end up so close together?
Well, what the researchers think happened is that CID 42 is actually the product of two galaxies slamming into each other. And since galaxies usually have a central black hole, it's possible that when these galaxies merged, that you would get two black holes.
So if this black hole is on its way out, how is it moving?
It's a good question. And with a little bit of more analysis, the astronomers found that the black hole seems to be being expelled from the galaxy at about 2,000 kilometers a second. And that speed matches the velocity expected to be imparted by asymmetric emission of gravitational waves. And this is basically ripples in space-time that Einstein predicted would be generated when heavy objects like black holes are accelerated. And if a black hole emits more gravitational waves in one direction than another, the body will recoil in the opposite direction with a speed fast enough to escape the galaxy.
Wow. Well, is this something that we're going to see more and more of as we increase our observations?
Well, hopefully not, because these solo black holes could be a lot of trouble. They are not fun to have around. They can even, the researchers say, alter the evolution of galaxies. So we wouldn't really want a lot of these out there. And the team doesn't really think there are. They think this is an extremely rare phenomenon. So don't be expecting a black hole to collide with Earth anytime soon.
It would make a good movie, though.
It would make a good movie.
Okay, well, what else is on the site this week, David?
Well, Sarah, for Science Now, we've got a story about why insects aren't the size of hawks anymore, something we can all be thankful for. Also about Pluto's newest moons, how much they weigh, and what they can tell us about the orbits of alien worlds. For Science Insider, we've got a story about a collaboration between Japan and the United States, predicting and dealing with future natural disasters. Also a story about the open access movement. This is a movement to grant the public free access to scientific research that is funded with taxpayer dollars. What is the latest on that? And finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science. This week's Science Live is about the microbiome. This is all of the microbes that live inside our body and how they influence our health. And next week's Science Live is tied to Father's Day in the U.S. It's about how fatherhood differs between different animal communities. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
I'll check that out. Thanks, David.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the online news editor for Science. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.